Several minutes ago, Snowdragon Mountain. Nall stood looking down at Republic City, miles away and 7,000 or so feet below him, and decided that the time had come to have a private word with his cousin. Gathering his will, he drew a deep breath, then spoke three syllables in the old tongue, his voice channeling ancient magic with a sound like thunder.
Yol-Valok!
Summoned by an elder shouting her name, Garnet had little choice in the matter. None at all, really, since this was the first time it had happened to her, and she had no idea what was going on. Hadn't even really been awake when she heard the sound at some level deeper than her ears, felt reality subtly twisted by the demands of the voice, and then she was not where she'd been. If she'd recognized what was happening, she might have turned it into a battle of wills, and possibly even won. But as it was, she simply found herself whisked from the warm comfort of her station by Annabel to a chilly mountaintop miles from the city.
"What the crap!"
the little red dragon declared. Uncoiling her body from around empty air, she looked around in complete confusion for a second, until she spotted her cousin standing a few yards away. He was in his human-like form, dressed up in those clothes that had made him look like one of Cora's relatives, and he was giving her a strange, grim look she had neither the context nor any real desire to parse.
"Drem your look, little red," said Nall. "We have to talk."
Garnet looked around a moment longer, taking a moment to get what he'd just done fully on board, then turned and fixed him with a venomous glare.
"Okay, A, how the hell did you do that? And B, never do it again," she snarled. "Do you have any idea how rude that was?"
Nall folded his arms. "Be quiet and listen," he said. "There are things you have to know about being a dragon, things the dreaming didn't teach you."
"You dragged me up to Angstberg so you could give me a lecture about being a dragon?" Garnet demanded. "I kinda think I've got that one, thanks. Look, if I don't get back down there right now, there is going to be hell to pay in a minute. Just undo whatever you just did, come on down to the island, and we'll talk about what an idiot you are when I've got more time."
6 weeks out of the shell, you have as much time as I say you have," Nall snapped.
"Now listen.
I'm trying to help you, although seeing you take this attitude, I'm no longer sure why."
"Help me? Help me?" said Garnet. "Of all the high-handed... If you wanted to talk to me so bad, you knew where I was. Why not just, I don't know, come see me? Or pick up a phone, like a normal person?"
"That's exactly my point," said Nall. "We're not normal people."
"Oh, and that gives us the right to teleport each other away from our loved ones with no warning, I don't think,"
Garnet shot back.
"Get over yourself, Furball. You may be older than me. About 3 eyeblinks older in dragon years, but that does not make you the boss of me. Now send me back to the island before Annabel notices I've gone. I've never left her while she was asleep before. I don't think she'd take it very well."
Nall scowled at her. "Then maybe you'd better stop spitting and hissing and just listen to what I have to tell you." Garnet facepalmed. Which involves a slightly epic bodily contortion in short-legged serpentine dragons.
"Fine, I'll walk," she said, unfurling her wings and taking to the air. "You can just stay up here and be all groovy with yourself for all I care."
Slightly to her surprise, her elder's response to this was to assume his fully draconic form, looming over her with his own feathery wings outspread.
"Sit down," he boomed.
Garnet wheeled, darted up, and hovered mere inches from his muzzle so she could glare into his eyes. The disparity in their sizes was such that he wouldn't even have had to chew her,
but she showed absolutely no fear as she shouted into his face. "Is that supposed to intimidate me? Is this what you're reduced to now, O mighty paragon of white dragons? Bullying 6-week-old hatchlings who have better things to do than listen to your teenage angst poetry? Well, let me tell you something, Freiherr von Arschgesicht. I've had about enough of... holy flying crap."
Nall's furious scowl became a puzzled one as she trailed off, her tiny face going slack, fire opal eyes fixed on a point somewhere behind him. Bending his long neck, he turned his head to look up and back, and then his own fanged mouth dropped open in astonishment.
Downtown, Cora emerged from a dockside warehouse, sweaty and begrimed. Behind her, the fire department had the problem contained and wouldn't require her assistance any further. So, with a grateful heart, she went to one of the open barrels of water set out for the refreshment of the firefighters and directed about half of its contents over her head, sluicing soot and dirt from herself and her modified police armor.
"Do I even really want a briefing on this one?" asked Inspector Eitaro Imanishi dryly from a few yards away.
"Believe it or not, it's actually not as bad as it looks," Cora replied, waterbending her hair dry again. "One of us is going to have to give Daisuke the 'why do we not go undercover without telling anyone' talk again, though. Not it!" Imanishi, who had opened his mouth to say the last two words himself, closed it again with a chuckle. The two colleagues grinned at each other for a second. Then Imanishi sighed and said, "Well, at least we don't have to raid this particular building now." Behind him, part of the warehouse collapsed. He didn't even blink, much less turn around to look.
"Thanks for your help, all the same. This could have gone a few different ways. Ray told me you were in the middle of something when she called."
Cora surprised the inspector by blushing slightly, her grin becoming a little bit wry.
"Nothing I can't get back to," she said, then frowned and added, "What's with them?"
Imanishi turned to look where she was pointing. There was a small crowd of people at the end of the block, being kept clear of the police line by a couple of uniformed officers, and suddenly everyone over there, civilians, cops, the lot, was pointing off to the northeast and exclaiming in surprise. Puzzled, the inspector and Cora turned to look in that direction. Two forms were circling one of the mountain peaks a few miles outside the city. At first, Cora thought they might be airplanes, until their long, sinuous shapes and the fluidity of their movements registered on her, and she realized with a profound shock who they were. Dragons. A pair of them, long and sleek, their scales flashing in the sunlight as they banked and wheeled in an intricate, interlocking aerial dance above and around the peak. One red, the other blue, but otherwise virtually identical. As far as she was aware, Cora knew all the dragons left in Dicho who had seen fit to make themselves known to anyone, and these two were especially unforgettable. All the more so because, based on everything she thought she knew about them, they shouldn't be there.
"Two dragons," one of the tinheads on crowd control cried. "What does it mean?"
Without pausing to speculate, Cora snatched her glider staff from where she'd left it leaning on a patrol car and dashed up the street. In one smooth sequence of movements, she shed parts of her armor as she ran. At the end of her takeoff run, having cast off all the heavy metal plates, she sprang into the air and unfurled the glider's wings, conjuring a gust as she did so to carry her aloft and direct her toward the mountains. Standing on the sidewalk where she'd just been, Imanishi watched her go, then silently set about collecting the pieces of her armor. Back at Snowdragon Mountain, the red and blue dragons continued their mesmerizing show for only a few minutes, swooping and circling, always in motion.
Neither spoke, nor even looked at either of the figures on the mountaintop, but neither Nall nor Garnet was under any illusions that they didn't know they were there. Garnet knew they were, because of the ineffable sensation of intense scrutiny she was feeling, and Nall knew because, although neither flying dragon spoke to him, they were both telling him plenty. And then, just as abruptly as they had appeared, they departed, breaking off their orbits and speeding away to the west with great, sweeping beats of their enormous wings. In mere seconds, they had disappeared. Nall returned to his human form with a whump of inrushing air, then stumbled and sat down in the snow, staring off toward the western horizon. Garnet, her wrath forgotten, settled on his shoulder and wound a coil of her long tail around his neck, as if to reassure him that she still existed. He was still there a minute later, when a pair of sky bison arrived. The spectacle of the blue and red dragons had, if Corwin was honest, rather short-circuited the confrontation he'd come up here expecting to have. As he and Utina disembarked from Mogi, they were still furious, of course. But at the sight of Nall sitting blank-faced in the snow, most of the fight went out of them. Lokpa, on the other hand, jumped down from Vayu's back, where, there not having been time to saddle him, she'd been clinging by fistfuls of his shaggy fur, and stormed across to him, her face scarlet with indignation. "I cannot believe you," she declared. "I've been helping you with this business for weeks, and what do you do? You turn around and do this the instant I have to go back to the island. And you knew I was going back to do something really hard, which you have now made much, much harder by causing such an almighty damn commotion, you imbecile." With that, she ran out of steam for the moment and simply stood before him, fists clenched, panting. When he didn't react, she snapped, "Well, what have you got to say for yourself?" Nall blinked, as if coming back from far away, and looked up at his furious paramour with a look of such childlike contrition that she found herself almost, but not quite, disarmed by it. "Yeah," he said, a trifle absently. "You're right. This was a major fail." He climbed slowly to his feet, head hanging. "I'm sorry." "Garnet, are you okay?" Utina asked in lieu of whatever she'd been planning to say. "I'm fine," Garnet replied, not leaving her spot on Nall's shoulder. "They didn't mean any harm, and they weren't here to see me anyway." She hesitated, then added with a sort of preemptive wince, I don't suppose Annabelle's still asleep." "No," said Corwin flatly. "No, she certainly is not." "Oh, crap," Garnet said, slumping. A moment later, Cora arrived, collapsing her glider and alighting a few yards away. "What in the hell is going on?" she demanded without preamble. Back on Air Temple Island, the two Sky Bison landed in front of Tenzin's house mere minutes later. While Nima and a still-simmering Lokpa sprang down from Vayu, Nall descended rather more sedately down Mogi's side, then walked like a prisoner under escort into the house, head down, arms slack at his sides. Corwin, Utina, and the sisters followed him. He didn't have a hard time figuring out where to go. All he had to do was follow the sound of the furiously crying infant. Annabelle was no longer at full air raid intensity, no longer producing frequencies that autonomically stimulated her parents' fight-or-flight reflex, but she still sounded mightily displeased. The group went to the front room to find Anthy, Jinora, and Iki doing what they could to soothe the red-faced infant. As they entered the room, Iki looked up and smiled. "Now this is more like what I remember," she remarked. To one side, her elder sister looked at her and nodded sagely, which, even under the circumstances, brought a little smile to Anthy's frazzled face. Nall trudged past Ikki and Janora to Anthy, but didn't meet her eyes. Instead, he bent down and murmured to Annabelle, "Hey, kiddo. I'm sorry about all this. Your Uncle Nall really screwed up. But here's Garnet, safe and sound." With that, he reached down and placed his hand gently against Annabelle's swaddled chest, making a bridge of his arm for Garnet to hurry down and coil herself protectively around the infant once more. The instant this was done, Annabelle quieted, but no one there could miss the fact that she still looked deeply unhappy, turning her face away from any attempt to soothe her further and making fractious, petulant noises. "You'll still be out of sorts for a while, poor thing," Ikki said kindly, smoothing the baby's ruffled hair. "But you've got your friend back now, and that's a start." "Ikki, would you be so kind?" said Anthy, offering her the bundle of baby and dragon. Looking puzzled, Ikki accepted it, cradling the child in a practiced way and freeing Anthy's hands. "Anthy, I'm..." Nall began. And then, to the stunned amazement of everyone in the room, she stepped slightly past him, put one foot behind his ankles, applied a flattened hand to his chest, and flung him flat on his back to the floor. Utterly unprepared for this, if anything, he'd been expecting her to slap him, he hit the hardwood with a crash, the wind rushing out of him, and lay there for a second trying to remember how that trick where you pull air into your body from outside worked again. "Nall, you ass," she hissed, her face a mask of outrage. "How dare you do that to my Annabelle? I came within a murmur of laying the darkest curse I know on you today." Nall stared up at her for a moment, his mouth working. Then he coughed, pulled in a fresh lungful of air, and sagged back against the floor with a miserable sigh. "I know," he said. "I'm sorry. You're right, I messed up big time. I had no right to do that. I just didn't think of the consequences." He sat slowly up, elbows on knees, and hung his head. "You'd have been well within your rights. I probably deserved to be cursed after that." The priestess glared at him for a moment longer, and Corwin and Utrina both started edging toward her in hopes of being able to intervene before she took her wrath any further. And suddenly the fury was erased by a gentle, slightly sad smile, and she reached down and took his wrist to help him up, then embraced him. "Thank you, Nall," she said quietly. "I accept your apology. You're forgiven. At least by me." She leaned back and gave him a wry, weary smile. "Annabelle may take a little longer." "And so will I," Lockpa growled, and without another word she turned and stalked out of the house. Nima hesitated, almost going after her, but then turned back and gave the rest of the room a helpless little shrug. Nall watched her go, then sighed. "Well, if I tried again now, I'd only piss her off more," he said glumly. Then, turning to Corwin and Utna, he added sheepishly, "But if everybody else doesn't mind, I think I'd really sort of like to come back inside now." As Ikki had predicted, Annabelle wasn't herself again for the rest of the day. She was restless and irritable, sleeping only fitfully, and much more clingy than usual. Normally, she was pretty laid back about being left to her own devices for periods of time, but now she demanded that someone be holding her more or less constantly. Fortunately, there was no shortage of people willing to do that, including Corwin, once he'd had a chance to change out of his suit and into a t-shirt and jeans. "Here," said Corwin, picking up Anthy's wrap from where it lay discarded by the couch. "I'll take the first shift. Why don't you go and lie down for a while? You look done in." "You are my hero forevermore," said Anthy sincerely, helping him with his arrangements, which, it had to be said, he'd gotten much better at since his catastrophic original attempt. Looking him in the eye, she added with a slight twinkle, "I don't care what the newspapers say about you."
Corwin laughed and leaned to kiss her, then tilted his head thoughtfully, plucked at the sleeve of her golden Air Nomad tunic, and asked, "Did you take time out in the middle of all that to change your shirt?"
"Never mind," Anthy replied, reddening slightly. "Come and wake me if she needs anything."
Corwin promised he would, saw her off to bed, and then retired to the sun porch, where he found Utrina stretched out on the futon reading a book. Everyone else appeared to have dispersed. He looked at his watch and saw that it was only a little past noon. By rights, he should have been exhausted. He was still on Turing III time, and the morning had been rather more eventful than he was expecting, but he didn't feel so bad, considering. He got a can of iced chai out of the mini-fridge, cracked it open, and sat down at the design desk, figuring he might as well reacquaint himself with what had gone on with the project in his absence.
"Hmm," he observed after a few minutes of fiddling. "You know what, Yartamin? Your dad can't really work the computer with you there."
Utrina looked up from her book.
"I can take her if you want to get some," she began,
but he shook his head, moved to the lower chair in front of the desk, and leaned back in it with his feet up, smiling. On his chest, Annabelle had at last gone quiet. Still awake, and still looking a bit fretful, but his arm over her and the sound of his heart, along with Garnet's restored presence, seemed to be settling her nerves.
"No, we're good right now," he said, then repeated in a low and soothing tone, "We're good."
Utrina smilingly watched as, despite having missed days of work, her husband, a man who had been known to forgo both sleep and food in the pursuit of completion on a project, willingly abandoned 2 hours of planned diligence in favor of just chillin' with his daughter, who needed some chillin' with. After a little while, he got up from the desk and joined her on the futon, and Annabelle seemed to enjoy that even more, with the warm and pleasantly scented presence of her other dad close at hand. They lay cuddled together, watching the afternoon go by outside the sun porch windows, and Utrina marveled inwardly at how right it all felt now, her worries and fears of the day after Annabelle's birth like dim and shadowy dream fragments, lost in time.
"So," said Corbin quietly at length, "this might be a good time for you to finish telling me what in the world was going on at breakfast."
Utrina glanced at him, then at the baby and Garnet. Annabelle was dozing fitfully, fidgeting a lot, and seeming to need constant reassurance that they were still there, but comfortable enough. Garnet, evidently worn out by the excitement of her day so far, had no such troubles and was sleeping like a rock.
"Okay," she agreed, nodding. "I can't remember where I got to, so why don't I just start over?"
It took her perhaps an hour to explain the intricate conversation she and Anthy had had with Cora on the foredeck of the Mirai, the night he'd first called from Turing III. Corwin kept quiet throughout, asking no questions and just absorbing what she was telling him with a neutral expression. Toward the end of the telling, Annabelle woke and began to cry again, but for perfectly mundane reasons this time. Without comment, Utrina unwrapped her from Corwin and took her away for some maintenance. She was gone for perhaps half an hour, and when she returned and resumed her station, she had the baby affixed to her own chest. "There," she said, settling in. "All squared away. I think she's starting to realize that everything's okay now," she added, stroking Annabelle's head with a smile. "Got her appetite back, at least. I think Anthy could use a couple more hours, though."
She was so out of it, she barely even woke up. Corwin nodded. Rough day all around. This must be what people with normal babies feel like all the time, he observed wryly. Makes you wonder how the species survives. Oh, hey, I never got a chance to tell you before all the excitement. You may be pleased to learn that, although it was like pulling teeth every frickin' step of the way, the Turing board did eventually see fit to recognize what's been painfully obvious to everyone else all along. Wally and Eve are citizens of the galaxy now. Or, well, of Zeta Cygni. That's great news, said Utina. What's next for them? Corwin chuckled. Like a lot of emancipated robots, Eve's gone right back to her old job, except now she gets paid. A lot, because she gets mileage, he added with a grinning wink. As for Wally, well, nobody knows how to keep a tidy home for a more adventurous spouse like a former sanitation worker. Utina kept her laugh light for Annabelle's sake, then snuggled closer and took his hand. Good to hear, she said. I'm glad you were able to help them. But gladder that you're back, she added with a kiss. If I had known what you had waiting for me, he said wryly, I'd have skipped the closing remarks. She gave him a mischievous smile. Oh, you liked that, did you? She inquired. I should probably feel as if I'm stumbling into a trap at this point, Corwin remarked. But you know me better than that, Utina rejoined. Yep, Corwin agreed. I knew you were trouble from the moment I saw you. And he leaned to kiss her. Get a room, you guys, Garnet mumbled, looking sleepily out from the wrap at Utina's chest. Then, peering around, she added, Oh, you have one. Very well, carry on, and ducked back into cover. Corwin and Utina gave each other bemused looks, then giggled. Most kids have security blankets that don't talk, Utina quipped wryly. Where's the fun in that? Corwin wondered with a smile. Then, sobering a little, he went on. Anyway. I never lie to you, right? You better not, Utina replied, smiling but serious. Well then, yeah, he said. I did like that. Not sure what to make of it, he qualified, but... Well, if it makes you feel any better, that makes two of you at the moment, said Utina. She kissed him again, gently, and went on. But at least now you've got a clear road to work it out. Corwin chuckled. You guys are one in a trillion. Or two in a trillion. One in 2 trillion? He shook his head. Gate lagged, too tired to math. Very, very rare, anyway. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good, Utina replied with a smile, quoting back an old song Corwin and his father both liked to quote, then added wryly, Anthe, I'm not so sure about sometimes. He came up with only an abstract chuckle for that. Seeing that he was fading fast, she kissed him on the forehead and held him close, murmuring, Sleep well, lover. Welcome home. Corwin woke to find the sun parlor dimly lit, and the world outside it dark but for the golden night glow of Republic City. He was still sleepy, but comfortably so, not that zombie adrenaline crash fatigue that had rolled over him earlier. Utina had gone, and Annabelle and Garnet with her, and someone had taken his boots off him and pulled a blanket up to his shoulders, for which he was abstractly grateful. He lay there for a few moments, trying to decide whether he should get up and go properly to bed, get up and get something to eat, or just go back to sleep, when his ear caught the faint, distinctive sound of the design desk's mouse being clicked. He sat up, yawning, and said in a low voice, "What did I miss?"
Cora, sitting at the computer's console, turned in her seat and smiled.
"Not much," she replied quietly. "Pretty low-key evening. Annabelle's still a little rattled, but I haven't heard anything in a couple hours now, so I think it's working out."
Nall wandered off again around dark, though he said he wasn't going far this time.
Corwin chuckled darkly. "Well, if Lockba turns up at breakfast with a stylish new hat, we'll know where he went," he said.
Cora nodded.
"She was pretty ticked at him," she agreed. "You can't really blame her, though. I mean, there's making a scene, and then there's that. Even if Annabelle hadn't noticed..."
She shook her head. "I spent all afternoon cleaning up after the dragon sightings in town. 10 car accidents, 4 religious conversions, 2 spontaneous firebending manifestations, and a premature birth. They named him Long, naturally," she added with a wry little grin.
Corwin swung his legs off the futon and sat on the edge, regarding her thoughtfully.
"What was the deal with that? I mean, they were impressive, don't get me wrong, but I thought Nima and Lockpa were having heart attacks for a second there."
"Dragons are rare in this world, remember," Cora told him. "A lot rarer than you're used to back in Asgard, from what I hear.
And those two in particular. Those two dragons were Ran and Shao, the ancient masters. The oldest, most powerful dragons in Dicho, as far as anyone knows, and the only ones in the Northern Hemisphere to survive the 100-year war. They've lived in seclusion for centuries. Apart from a few trusted retainers, they never see anyone. Even I've only met with them once. So for them to appear like that in broad daylight within sight of the city, they must have thought it was pretty damned important."
"Well, whatever they had to say to Nall, he seems to have taken it to heart," Corwin mused. "There was no fight in him at all by the time we got there. Even when we got back here, Anthy was furious. And trust me, however mild and retiring she seems, you don't want Anthy furious with you."
"I can believe that," said Cora, nodding.
"But Nall just took what she gave him and said he deserved it," Corwin went on. "I've never seen him like that before."
He sighed heavily, shoulders slumping.
"Life used to be simpler."
"Huh, tell me about it," Cora replied. Corwin yawned again, then raised his watch and pressed the stud that illuminated the face. 10:30, he mused, then ran his hands back through his hair and hunted up his boots. "My hunger curve just crossed my fatigue curve. I want Bowsy. You want Bowsy? Let's go get some Bowsy."
Cora gave him a thoughtful look, then smiled and clicked the design desk over to sleep mode.
"Sure, why not?" she said. "Let's."
Lockpa lay on her narrow bed in her room in the ladies' quarters, her bedside lamp turned down low, staring at the ceiling and thinking about her path. By this point her thoughts were largely circular, and so not getting her anywhere useful, but she wasn't sure she could turn them off and go to sleep. Even meditating, something she was normally pretty good at, hadn't worked tonight, and since lying in bed in her nightshirt and not sleeping was marginally more comfortable than sitting fully clothed on the floor and not sleeping, she'd opted for it an hour or so ago. She was about to turn off the lamp altogether and try her best to get to sleep when she heard a gentle tapping at the window to the right of the head of her bed. For a few seconds she tried to ignore it, but it kept coming, and there was such a piteous quality about it that she couldn't tune it out without feeling heartless. Finally, with a sigh, she turned on her side and unlatched the window. Nall nudged the pane up with his cat-like nose and looked in, his crimson eyes glinting in the lamplight. Are you still mad? He said in a small voice.
A little, Lakpa replied, rolling onto her back again, but she didn't close the window. Flattening himself to the sill, Nall crawled through the narrow gap, easing the window up a little bit more with his shoulder so he could be sure he wouldn't catch his furled wings.
I'm really sorry, he said. I thought I needed to do that in order to sort of put a cap on everything I've been working through. There are things I still want to talk to her about, things I want to warn her about. And I thought if I could just get her alone for a couple of minutes, she'd hear me out and everything would be fine.
He hung his head.
I should have known it wouldn't work.
Yes, said Lakpa, doing her best to sound cold. You should have.
Nall nodded.
I mean, would I have listened if some other dragon, barely older than I am, did that to me? No, of course I wouldn't. So why would I assume that Garnet would? I'm such a dope.
Yes, said Lakpa. You are.
Nall considered for a second, then said,
You don't have to agree with me every time I say that.
You ruined everything, Lakpa snapped, turning her head to glare at him. You know what today was going to be.
I know, said Nall, drooping. And I'm sorry. I can't seem to do anything right lately.
He sighed.
Sorry, I'll go. I won't bother you again. I hope everything works out.
He turned and slunk back toward the window.
Goodbye, Lakpa.
He hesitated, then said in a still smaller voice,
Love you.
Without a word, she rolled onto her side again, reached past him, and shut the window in his face, so abruptly that he nearly ran into it. He recoiled in surprise, then looked back over his shoulder at her, blinking.
Lakpa?
Lakpa regarded him inscrutably for a moment, then raised the corner of her bedspread.
Come here,
she said, in a voice not far short of command.
Nall gave her a wary look, then did as he was told, crawling under the covers and arranging himself with his head below her chin.
She drew the bedspread over them, then reached and shut off the light.
You are an idiot, Nalyunix Yutsiarit, Lakpa murmured.
I know, Nall replied. She leaned down and kissed his snout.
And so am I, because I love you too.
If anyone driving or walking across the Kyoshi Bridge at around 11 o'clock that night had chanced to look up, he or she might have been startled to see a couple of figures sitting on the massive crossbeam at the top of one of the suspension towers, and doubly so to realize that they weren't up there for any of the usual reasons people had for climbing the city's bridges. They weren't planning a parachuting stunt, preparing to unfurl a protest banner or unauthorized art installation, or thinking about ending it all. They were just having a picnic. Cora and Corwin sat on the tower with a paper sack from the Baozi experts between them, looking off toward the lights of Future City, and munching Cha Siu Bao. For the duration of 3 buns apiece, the only other sound, apart from the whispering of the light breeze and the distant night sounds of the city, was the soft pinging of Corwin's J5 jetpack cooling. Corwin finished off his 3rd bun, licked the traces of barbecue sauce from his fingers, and sighed.
This is nice, he said.
Cora agreed, nodding. She couldn't say more than that for the moment, because she was still working on the last bite of her own 3rd helping.
A moment later, they both reached into the bag for one of the two Do Sha Bao waiting at the bottom. This occasioned a brief mock turf war, elbowing and shoulder bumping, before they each got their dessert. They ate those in silence, too. Then Corwin wadded up the empty bag and stuffed it into a side pocket of his jacket, mumbling, "Pack out your trash." Cora nodded, chuckling, and they sat for a bit longer, just enjoying the evening. "So while you were out cleaning up after Nall today," Corwin said at length, "Utrina brought me up to date on a few things that happened while I was stuck on Turing 3. Cora glanced at him, her expression curious, but no more. "Yeah?" she said. "Yeah. Remember you asked me once if it's a timeshare sort of thing, and I said it's a very improvisational sort of thing?" Corwin asked. Cora nodded. "Mm-hmm." "Well," said Corwin, "this is me." He moved about halfway toward her and offered his hand. "Improvising." After a moment's hesitation, Cora slid across the space between them and took it, the two of them leaning warmly together. He was so much taller than she was now that her head ended up on his shoulder, rather than the other way around, but apart from that, it felt very much like the old days. At this realization, she gave a sigh of mixed relief and contentment, relaxing fully into the moment. "And Corwin will always be Corwin," she thought, "even on Judgment Day." "Goodweird?" she asked. "Goodweird," Corwin agreed, kissing her cheek. They sat there in a warm and pleasant silence for some time, watching the lights of the city and reflecting on the strange paths which life sometimes takes. Presently, though, it occurred to Cora that falling asleep in her current position would be a bad call, and since she had just very nearly done so, perhaps it was, with the greatest reluctance, time to call it a day. Just as she thought it, Corwin stirred, then said, "Well, I hate to say it, but..." And here his words blurred into a titanic yawn.
"If I don't get back to bed soon, I will fall off this bridge."
Cora chuckled. "Yeah, me too," she admitted, and they got slowly to their feet. Turning to face Air Temple Island, Corwin slipped on his jetpack's hand controls, while Cora picked up her glider staff. Just before he'd have triggered his jetpack's main thrust, Cora put a hand on his shoulder and said, "Hey, Corwin?" He paused, half turning back to face her. "Hmm?" he replied. Cora gathered him up in a long hug and kissed him, rather more gently than she had at breakfast. When she stepped back, she left her hand on the side of his face for a moment, her smile just visible in the city glow. "I'm glad we're still us," she said quietly. Corwin nodded. "Yeah," he said, reaching up to cover her hand with his own. "So am I." Then, with a grin, he added, "Race you back," before pivoting and rocketing away. "Oh, no you don't," Cora laughed, leaping off the bridge tower after him. Anthy finished feeding Annabelle, tidied up, and observed with pleasure that her daughter's nerves seemed to have settled considerably. She was still a bit restless, but went promptly back to sleep. Smiling, Anthy left her and Garnet tucked in Utrina's arms, and what a sight that was, then went quietly down the hall to the sun parlor. She found it empty, dark, and silent, but for the quiet hum of the sleeping design desk. With a soft sigh, she settled on the futon, stretched out her legs, and reclined there for a while, collecting her thoughts and watching the lights of the ships moving in and out of Republic City Harbor. It had been a hectic day in more senses than one. She wasn't sure how long she'd been sitting there, lost in thought, when she heard a soft sound, looked up from her reverie, and saw Cora very gently opening the sliding door from the veranda, partly leading but mostly carrying Corwin, who was virtually asleep on his feet. Anthy was reminded powerfully of the first night she'd known him, in Asgard, after his trial and before her wedding. With an indulgent smile, she rose from the futon and went to help Cora manage her charge. They said nothing, only made smiling, nodding eye contact in the dark as they got his jetpack, jacket, and boots off him, then maneuvered him to the futon and put him the rest of the way to bed. Corwin submitted robotically to their ministrations, never actually waking. In the morning he would have no memory of how he had gotten from the clearing in the bamboo grove, where he and Cora had landed, to the parlor. Their work done, the two women stood silently regarding him for a few moments. Still without a word, Cora turned and hugged Anthy warmly, then let herself quietly out of the house, bound for her own quarters. Humming a cheerful little tune, Anthy bent and kissed Corwin's forehead, made a final adjustment to the covers, and then went back to bed herself. Monday, April 26th. Monday saw something like a return to routine for the Tenjos and Corwin. Sitting down to breakfast at Cora's regular table in the Air Temple dining hall, Utena remarked to herself that it felt a bit like coming home, at least as much as, for instance, having a meal in the dining commons at Tenjo Academy did. At the head of the table, Cora slipped easily back into the old groove as well, pulling Section 4 out of the morning's Republic City Tribune and giving it a quick once-over. "Ha," she said with a satisfied smile. "Nothing to report except the dragon sightings." She folded the paper down and grinned over it at Corwin. "Guess we know what it takes to keep us off page 4-1 now." "That may be a difficult standard to maintain," Corwin observed with a wry smile. Cora might have replied, but before she had the chance, her gear phone pinged with an incoming message. Raising an eyebrow, she put down the paper, got out the phone, and checked it, her face breaking into a delighted smile. "It's from Rio," she said. "They're starting on the structural steel today." She looked up from the phone. "Let's go up and check it out." "Would you like to go and see how our new house is coming along, Annabelle?" Anthy inquired. Annabelle didn't seem entirely sold on the idea. She wasn't as upset today, but she still seemed a bit wary, as if not quite convinced that nothing else was going to happen. But she raised no specific objections, so her parents concluded that they might as well give it a try and see how far they could get. After breakfast, the Air Acolytes saddled Mogi for Corwin while he and the ladies packed a picnic lunch and their day-tripping things, and off they went. If anything, their daughter seemed happier in the air than she had on the ground, possibly because Utena, taking a turn as carrier, had cinched her wrap extra snug as a precautionary measure. While the three, Annabelle and Garnet, cruised along on Mogi, Cora paced them with her glider staff, occasionally performing little aerobatic stunts as they encountered gusts and updrafts. She was in a fine, expansive mood, all good cheer and bonhomie, which set Utena's mind at ease. She had hoped that the Avatar and Corwin might get a little time alone that evening, as she left Corwin asleep in the project office and Cora came by after she finished her business downtown. They had, after all, plenty to talk about privately. She didn't know if they had, and though burning with curiosity about it, she'd had sense enough not to bring it up at breakfast. But Anthy had that satisfied, I-know-something look about her,
And if Cora's mood and Corwin's this morning were any indication, then even if they hadn't reached some kind of conclusion, they had at least decided not to let it bother them. For that, Uchnu was grateful. After retiring to bed with Anthy and Annabelle, she'd felt a momentary wave of doubt that she'd done the right thing by provoking Cora as she had at breakfast. Not out of some late-rising pang of jealousy, but because she had belatedly realized that, while entertaining, it hadn't been the most tactful way she could have raised the subject. However, all appeared to be well, and though unable to investigate further for the moment, she was content. With that, and with the fact that Annabelle finally seemed to have recovered the bulk of her sang-froid. She was now snuggled into her wrap against Utrina's chest with Garnet, the picture of infant contentment. Since they'd reached cruising altitude, something in the soothing rhythm of the sky bison's subtle movements, or the cool rush of the passing wind. Or maybe, Utrina thought wryly, just the lower air pressure, had swept away the last of her lingering anxieties, which had made her unusually restless and needy throughout the night. Looking up from her contemplation of child and dragon, she smiled at Anthy and said, "Make a note, Himemia. Next time anything like that happens, we should take her flying and see if that helps sooner." Anthy nodded sagely. "Already noted," she said. She looked up as, with a cheery whoop, Cora pulled an airbender glider trick only she could manage, giving herself a burst of extra thrust by firebending from her feet as if wearing rocket boots, and turned an inside loop around Mogi, who glanced back over his shoulder as if thinking, "Show off," before settling back into formation with him again. "Cora seems in high spirits this morning," Anthy observed with a slightly mischievous smile. Uchnu nodded. "Mm-hmm." They arrived in the coombe between the triple peaks of Mount Weitang to find the site very different from when they'd last seen it. The waterfall, the lake, and the meadow were still there, but there was also a road leading up the valley from the south. Between lake and meadow lay a cleared and leveled area that bustled with activity. The house's foundations were complete, from the basement that would be under the part of the edifice standing on land to the piers to support the part that would overhang the lake shore. Much of the first floor had been laid atop them, and a small crew of workers was busy erecting the main structural members for what would stand above it. As Corwin guided Mogi to a gentle landing 50 yards or so from the job site, the door of the temporary building by the end of the road opened, and Ryo Sato emerged smiling broadly at the sight of them. "Welcome home, son," he declared cheerfully, approaching with arms wide. "Ladies," he added, helping first Anthy, then Uchna down from Mogi's back. "Starting to look like somebody's actually working out here," said Corwin with a grin as he shook Rio's hand. "Any trouble so far?"
"Not a bit," Ryo replied. "Come on, I'll show you what we've done so far."
Cora completed a circuit of the site, checking it out from every angle, and landed by Mogi, collapsing her glider staff with a flourish. "Good morning, Cora," said Ryo with a bow. "I understand you had some excitement yesterday morning." "You could say that," Cora said with a rueful smile. "Unannounced visit from the ancient masters. Had the town in a bit of an uproar for a while there." Ryo shook his head in wonder. "I wish I could have seen that," he said. "I was working downstairs at the time. Still, no regrets," he added, grinning. "I think you'll agree when you see what I was up to down there that it was worth it. Let's start up top, though." "I'm glad you left the rocks," Uchnu noted, pointing to the jumble of boulders along the lakeshore to the right of the spot where the house was going up. "Hey, who doesn't like a nice lakeshore rock garden?" Corwin said with a grin. "Besides, I saw the way you and Anthy seemed to take to them when we were here before. Figured they'd make a good vantage point to sit and check out the whole scene once it's done." He paused by one of those rocks now,
placing a hand on it, and stood regarding the waterfall tumbling down Mount Weitang's center peak's south face and into the lake. After a moment's reflection, he recited, "In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea."
"At least I assume that's where this goes," he added, indicating the lake. "I don't see an outlet anywhere, and this water's got to be going somewhere, so I figure there must be an underground river." "Which is pretty cool."
"We are not calling the house the Pleasure Dome," Utna remarked wryly. "Or Xanadu. I've seen Citizen Kane."
"Aw, but," said Corwin, and Anthy giggled. Watching the scene, Cora and Ryo just shared a smile. As they approached the house, Utna was struck by a little flash of glee as she noticed the distinctive shape of a Future Industries mecha builder standing off to one side, its styling slightly more modern than that of the century-old one she'd seen in pictures, but unmistakable. It was shut down, its cockpit hatch open.
"Checking out my ride?" Ryo quipped as he noticed her eyeing the machine. "Isn't she sweet? The very latest Mark 44. Gas turbine power plant, shaft drives for 4 separate attachments, all-terrain traction. With 4 of those and pilots who know what they're doing, you could build a whole town in a week, if the people who live there weren't picky about finish work or landscaping," he added with a grin. Then he angled a thumb at Corwin and Cora and added, "However, the great artiste and his engineer here are picky about both, so I'm just using her for heavy lifting on this job."
"Oh, right, Ryo, as if you're not just as bad," said Corwin. "Finished restoring that motorcycle yet?"
"Just needs a few more tweaks,"
Ryo replied mock defensively, then laughed and clapped him on the shoulder.
"You're right, though. I do love to do a thing right. That's why I'm enjoying this job so much. No deadlines, no screaming clients, no bean-counting bureaucrats. I can use the best materials, hire the right people, and tell them to take their time and do it right. In the end, it saves time and money."
He brightened as a thought occurred to him.
"Oh, and speaking of the right people, I owe you one, son. Because of you, I've managed to hire myself a real wizard."
Corwin arched an eyebrow. "Because of me?" he said, confused.
"Yep. Let me show you."
Ryo led the way to one of the steel columns that would eventually hold up the corners of the main house. Up above them, suspended in a sling rig from the top of the column itself, an ironworker was welding on a cross brace that would eventually support one of the roof trusses. Corwin, with his perennial eye for the technical detail, found himself initially interested in the welder rather than the person wielding it. It was a backpack rig consisting of a metal frame supporting a pair of compressed gas cylinders and a wire reel, connected by hoses not to a torch or gun as in the normal sort of MIG welder, but an articulated metal gauntlet, almost like something one might expect to find on a suit of powered armor back home. The operator, anonymous in welding hood and heavy protective apron, was directing the arc from the tip of his index finger and drawing the weld accordingly. For a second, Corwin wondered where the power to drive the obvious electric arc was coming from. There was no sign of a generator or transformer, or even a power feed cable to the gauntlet, until it suddenly dawned on him that it must be coming from the operator.
"Is that?" he wondered, gesturing.
Ryo nodded.
"Yep, my newest invention. I call it the lightning welder. Ink's hardly even dry on the patents yet."
The operator finished the weld he was working on, shut off the arc, and then seemed to notice that he was being watched. With unhurried movements, he unlatched from the sling rig and slid down the column like a fireman descending a pole, landing lightly despite the bulky weight of the welder on his back. Then he turned, reached up with his left hand, on which he wore only a heavy leather work glove, and pulled off his hood, revealing that he was a she, and in fact a she Corwin knew.
Zanya, he said, his eyes going wide. Zanya, formerly the notoriously foul-prone firebender for the Frostbite Point Ice Wraith's Major League Bending team, until an exhibition match against the Fire Ferrets, with Corwin subbing for their absent Earthbender, had broken up the team, gave him a sardonic little smile. She was far from looking her best, her face bathed in sweat and short hair frazzled, and yet there was something about her that was entirely different and more pleasant to behold from when Corwin had last seen her, more than a month before. Then she had been angry, frustrated, and had given the impression that she'd been so for a long time, maybe most of her life. Now she looked calmer somehow, settled, maybe even content. She was still wearing that false eye patch over her left eye, but that reservoir of constantly simmering rage that he'd sensed bubbling within her before seemed to have diminished, if not gone altogether. She unclipped a water bottle from a quick-release holster on her hip, took a swig, then snapped it back into place and said, "Well, if it isn't Watari Karasu, I heard you left town." Corwin smiled. "Don't believe everything you read. What brings you out here?" "You know how it is," Zanya replied. "When you've got my skill set, you have four career choices. Pro-bending, construction, the triads, or... well, the triads, but a different department, if you get my meaning. The pro game and I are on a break right now. Burning down people's houses didn't appeal, and I'm too ugly for the other thing, so..." She shrugged with affected nonchalance. "Figured I'd find out what honest work was like." She glanced back up at the top of the column, then went on, "Speaking of which, I'd better get back to it. See you around, Karasu," she said with that same wry smile, and then she put her hood back on and started clambering back into position. "She showed up here while we were at the South Pole, looking for work," Ryo explained as he guided the others across the open decking that would one day be the first-story subfloor. "Li Wen, my site foreman while I was away, put her to work as a general labor welder's assistant, but she's a natural with a lightning welder. Not all lightning benders can handle it. She makes it look easy." He shook his head with a smile. "You sure can pick 'em, Corwin." "I didn't pick her. She just happened to be on the team we were playing against when Cora shanghaied me into subbing for Xiang Wan," Corwin replied. "Kismet, son, kismet," said Ryo expansively. "Now, ladies and Corwin, prepare yourselves. You are about to see what I personally think is the best part of the house. Even those of you who designed the place are going to be amazed at what you see. I know what you're thinking, but Ryo, the house isn't even here yet. And that is indeed true. But once you see what's in the basement," he added with a wink, "I think you'll agree that the rest of the place is just going to be for decoration."